Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Gigabit Nation, Broadband Talk Radio. I'm your host, Craig Settles, and I want to welcome everyone in the audience today and thank you for taking time to be with us. Gigabit Nation's here to provide useful information and insights to help communities, companies, and nonprofit organizations get more, better broadband to everywhere it needs to be in America. Today, we're actually going to continue a theme that we started last week, which is communities have more options than they think for moving broadband projects forward. Money, of course, is often the root of all delays in pulling the trigger on some of these projects. But other times, it's also a hostile political environment that gets community broadband network projects put on the back burner. Now, one way to move these projects forward is to develop co-ops and nonprofits, which is what we discussed on last week's show with Wally Bowen. Today, we're going to explore the option of creating a community foundation. And if you've never heard of these, you're in for a very informative and energizing session with us because this is really some fascinating stuff that I think has a lot of potential for many communities, both urban and rural. Our guest is Sharon Stroh, who's the Director of Business Development for IMAN, which is the supporting organization for the Steuben County Community Foundation and one of the driving forces behind that community's broadband project. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
And we also have Bill Geiger, who is the CEO for IMAN, and also Jad Donaldson, who's the network administrator. So we have a full crew here to just dive right in and get to the topic at hand. So, Sharon, this whole idea of a community foundation may be new to folks. What exactly is that, and how do you form one?
Well, I'll start at the beginning, Craig. There are over 700 community foundations already established nationally, the largest concentration of which already exists in the Midwest, particularly in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Many of your listeners may already know who their contact is, but I do have a website that will give you a community foundation locator. It is sponsored by the Council on Foundations. And we can, I can give that to you now, or we can wait until a later time.
Oh, we could probably. Well, yeah, I mean, you can go ahead and give it now. That way, it'll be on the air, and then you can send me that, and I can post it to the page later.
No problem. Of course, it's www.cof.org/locator. If there isn't a community foundation close, another neutral community-centered public charity, such as an economic development corporation or a regional economic marketing partnership, may also be useful. And if these resources are also not available, a community foundation can be created through a standard legal filing for charitable status with the IRS. Couple of things just to be aware of. You'll want to make sure that you have both legal and accounting representation for the document preparation. There's also a filing fee involved, and that'll depend on your state. And you will also need to file with your Secretary of State to get your business entity report. And, of course, a great resource would be to contact the Council on Foundations, which is part of that website that I gave you early. They are nationally recognized for membership organizations such as community foundations, and they're based out of D.C.
Okay. Excellent. So it doesn't sound like an onerous process to create one of these, though clearly you do have to pay attention to the legalities and the paperwork and so forth and so on.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But it is a pretty simple process.
Okay. So now how does a foundation like this get its financing, or is that sort of a it varies with every location kind of issue?
A community foundation builds its asset base through donor contributions for a variety of purposes that they wish to support. Economic development can be one such area. In IMAN's case, funding was obtained through conversations with local government, business, utilities, educational facilities, and private foundation representatives. As of now, IMAN has raised about $2.7 million and has another just over $200,000 in requests for funding pending.
Mm-hmm.
I think our original goal was to raise about $3.2 million, but we've managed to keep costs down, and many of the items have come in under budget. So we feel really comfortable with the progress that we've made. But I will be honest, Craig, this has definitely been a public-private partnership, and I know you have talked about that a number of times as well on your show.
Mm-hmm. So you said you've raised over $2
million? $2.7.
Wow.
And we have another $200,000 in grant requests that are still pending. We haven't heard the outcome of those yet.
Uh-huh. And is this... I guess the question, well, one of several questions would probably be, in the current economic climate, does this current climate make fundraising for the foundation or for a foundation more difficult than usual, or have you seen, you know, it sort of stay at a steady state?
You know, the answer to that is multiple. I will tell you that if folks have disposable income, charitable giving is still a great way for them to use that.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to give it to something where it's going to provide the greatest good for them, for their own communities, makes it pretty simple. And they get the tax deduction for it.
Right.
Now, obviously, if you're in an economic situation where there is very little disposable income, yeah, you're going to have some difficulties. So that's when you have to make your case for support that much more important.
Okay.
And we go back to the mainstays of what broadband means to us. It is the infrastructure challenge of the 20th century, 21st century. It's as important now as electricity was in the 1800s. You know, you just keep driving that message.
Mm-hmm. So
that's what makes it important.
So let's separate for a second. We have the process for building the or creating the foundation. Then at some point you identify what the foundation's purpose is going to be. So I mean, in theory, the foundation can have a multifaceted purpose or purposes. And broadband would just be one of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or you could just say we're going to do this foundation specifically to create and support a broadband network.
Either way would work for you, Craig.
Okay. Is there any sense of, an advantage going one way or the other? You know, let me try it hypothetically. Would a community be more likely to get greater support if the mission was economic development across the board, of which broadband is maybe the key or the keystone of it all? But, you know, as opposed to we're going to do this foundation just to do broadband.
I would say that depends on your situation, Craig. But I will tell you that the Steuben County Community Foundation was established in 1992. So it already had a very stable presence in Steuben County before this economic and broadband initiative came along.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already in place, and that's what made it that neutral entity that we were looking for. It made sense for it to be the place where the profits, so to speak, from our subscriber fees would go. And that way they would be recycled, so to speak, into the community in the form of grant making.
Now, how does the grant making process typically work? You set up the money. I mean, obviously, that's the clear part. And then you have some X number of people that come in and say, okay, we want to get a grant for whatever. But is there a recommended process, or does each foundation establish its criteria for, you know, who's eligible, who will actually be on the review committee, you know, all those logistics of the granting process?
Again, I think that depends on your situation, but I will tell you the IRS will tell you some of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the IRS explains very clearly what you can and cannot make grants to as a public charity. In other
okay.
words, you can't do anything that's sectarian. You can't do anything that's politically involved. you know, but you can do grant making for health and human services, education, environmental preservation, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So
that is up to the board of directors that govern the community foundation.
Right, okay. But needless to say, you have some what I would call federal guidelines, and then you have the local sort of response within the framework of those guidelines, and then that becomes your funding process.
That's correct.
Okay. So now, what is a supporting organization?
It's the legal description that's awarded by the IRS to an organization, allowing it to use the umbrella of an already established 501c3 public charity. In other words, IMAN supports the Steuben County Community Foundation. So the Community Foundation is supported and IMAN is supporting. That's how that relationship works.
Okay.
IMAN has its own tax ID number. They file its own 990 and audit reports, but they use the charitable status of the Community Foundation. Classic example here is a university endowment fund. The supporting organization raises the funds to support either operations or scholarship programs at the university, but doesn't necessarily involve itself in the education of students. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. IMAN works the same way. IMAN builds fiber so that the subscriber fees come in and are used for grant-making purposes.
Gotcha. All right. So let's talk about, the financial numbers and the projections and so forth that are developed, because at some point I'm gathering that became, you know, someone said, okay, well, this is a lot of money. We got to do X, Y, and Z and so forth. How did you go about the process of figuring out that this would be a successful venture once you plunged into it?
Craig, this is one of those moments where I'm going to hand it off to Bill.
Okay.
So you're going to be hearing from him to answer that question.
Yeah, Craig?
Yes.
The answer to that is this is a need-driven fiber build, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And our current need in Steuben County was the city of Angola. They had a need to connect their facilities, their wastewater department, the street department, and other offices, parks department. They had $150,000 they were going to spend, and IMAN had a vision 4 years previous to them spending that of developing IMAN and becoming a supporting organization, which was a 3-year process. We got accepted as a supporting organization, and we had all the legal work done, but we of course, had no funding. But the city of our city, Angola, in Steuben County, had that need to connect those offices. So they gave IMAN their $150,000 check, if I may say, to invest to connect their facilities, at which time we built an infrastructure that consisted of 96 fibers. The city needed 6 of those 96. On the path of building the backbone, we went by Steuben County government, we went by the hospital, and we went by our schools. And we made connections for the hospital, the schools, and the government, of which they paid a fee to be connected month to month. And from that, those fees collected month to month, we continued building another half mile or a mile for about 7 years until we grew to where we are today. So this started back in 2003, and as of to date, we're pushing around 75 miles of fiber, 40 connections, generating revenues around $80,000 a year. And this is these dollars are dollars that we've been putting back into the build and building forward. So that is how we started. It's a puzzle, and it doesn't take hundreds and thousands of dollars to start. It's a process, It requires somebody in the community to just step up and say, we want to have a neutral fiber for our communities, and the return on investment can come back to the communities for community projects. IMAN does not sell services. It just builds the path, the fiber path, to serve businesses for point-to-point connections, and also allows for-profit service providers to come in and sell services.
So it is an open access network.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Which really is dovetails with what I think is starting to become more and more the accepted path in communities, which is let us build the infrastructure, let others come in and provide the services, because it tends to be, number one, I think more financially secure of an option, because you're not getting into the ups and downs of service, you know, selling service, and at the same time you're developing the infrastructure, and we start to think about the internet differently when we think about it as an infrastructure versus, oh, this is some entertainment channel that we're building.
Correct.
Craig, let me break in here. This is Jed, and let me say that where it really starts to pay benefits is kind of twofold. One thing is that a community that builds their own fiber network isn't going to pay an outside company that may not want to invest in their community due to the inherent risk of loss of not having enough people sign up for it. So, you know, where the price points become extraordinary because of the shareholder value that needs to be built into a public entity that wants to come into a community and build a fiber network, a community foundation doesn't have that fiduciary responsibility to shareholder value. Therefore, the price and the cost of the fiber doesn't need to be as high and as marked up as it would be. So it reduces the barrier of connection for all the community businesses and entities to be able to connect up to the fiber network. It makes it much less expensive and much more palatable. Combined with the fact that since it's being housed through the Community Foundation as the funding source, the not-for-profit status allows us to raise money through all forms of fundraising that we don't have to worry about having to make the money back on the subscription fees. So when we're able to raise $2.7 million, we can move forward driving $80,000 a year to start with as a revenue stream for the foundation, while any other corporation would have to pay not only interest on the $2.7 million, would have to pay the $2.7 million back, would have to do all these other things with that money that would drive the cost up and would act as a barrier for the hospital, the school districts, and the county offices and the city offices to be able to connect to it.
Huh. That definitely answers a lot of questions, a lot of the challenges. I mean, basically it all comes down to money. I mean, everything obviously does. But it also is consistent with the, you know, theme that those of us who advocate broadband and community broadband in particular have, that if we take this equation out of the normal corporate business mode where you have the stockholder issue that trumps just about everything else, you create a less expensive outlay. And you also remove, you open up opportunities for a more competitive environment, but you're also at the same time reducing risk on the community side, because that's always been an objection in the past. You know, it's like, well, we can't do this because taxpayer dollars will be at risk. And the dynamics, particularly of this foundation, if I'm, you know, understanding everything correctly, is that we're just changing all of the dynamics which lead to all of the problems, and then enabling us to move forward in a way that is not as expensive, and there will still be opportunities for private sector companies to make a dollar.
Yeah, that's correct. And by as you just pointed out, by being an open network, so to speak, if the private companies want to come in, you know, they don't have a barrier to entry either, because they're not having to worry about having to build the fiber network. The foundation doesn't have the risk because, as we all know in the broadband world, the fiber optic cable that we're installing today is made of the exact same patent technology that was built in the 1960s. It hasn't aged at all. It has no latency built into it. you know. So the only thing that gets better with fiber technology is the electronics we put on the end. And at IMAN, we don't profess the technology that goes on the end. We simply offer the dark fiber solution and allow our customers to light that fiber to whatever need they have, whether that's, you know, connecting two MRI machines across the county, connecting hospitals and with doctor's offices, or connecting the entire school districts of five different communities together so that they can all share from the same single-point internet feed. They're able to light that fiber, certainly at their expense, which is nominal at best. There's not a lot of cost in lighting the fiber, and we're not in a position to have to support technology or support any electronics in any way, shape, or form. We simply just support the backbone. And as Bill likes to point out, we call that the umbilical cord or the extension cord from building to building and community to community. And by housing this in the foundation, certainly there's a win. The foundation fronts the money and the build. But then the foundation, you know, I think in our build out, 60 cents of every dollar is heading back to the community foundation. When we're all said and done, it's a pretty easy sell to walk up to the president or CEO of a business that's in our community and ask him to be part of this network for the betterment of his organization and the reduction in the operating cost of his company, the direct bottom line operating cost reduction, and therefore telling him that, look, the best part about this is 60 cents of every dollar you spend on your monthly fees is going to end up right back in the Steuben County Community Foundation. You know, what's the downside to this? There is none.
You're right. Okay, that definitely makes a lot of sense. Now, do you what kind of providers have you found have been most receptive? Is it the ISPs, wireless ISPs, telecom companies? Who's an anxious player for this?
Well, the ISP, you know, traditionally the small to medium-sized ISP is going to be the one that's going to jump in, the local player. Whoever that local person is going to be who's going to do it. You know, it's interesting. In a rural community, of course, this is where this plays the best. It's going to be a little hard to go to a Minneapolis-St. Paul or to a Columbus, Ohio, or to even a Fort Wayne, Indiana, and think that you're going to put in a private fiber network. It's going to be a little more difficult because those communities really have a large volume of business that is already supporting, through the private sector, some fairly significant networks and some fairly significant fiber networks for that matter. But when you go to the rural communities, those fiber networks are never going to get built. You're never going to find the corporations that are going to be willing to spend the kind of money that's going to be necessary to connect those communities together. So when the foundation does that, it really offers the opportunity now for a small to medium-sized internet service provider to come in and say, okay, I'll supply the services on top of your fiber, and I'll lease the fiber back for each of my customers, and I'll connect them up, and we'll do internet access, and we'll do, you know, voice over IP services, and we can do shared bandwidth options. We can do off-site backup and storage solution options. And these are all things that, quite frankly, Craig, the small to medium-sized businesses that are in these rural communities have traditionally never been able to have available to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that were wanting to buy it were paying top dollar for it. You know, we talk about it in Steuben County even today, and to bring in a 1.5 meg T1 connection from the local telephone company is still $400 to $500 to $600 a month. That's a significant cost to a small business for
mm-hmm.
a 1.5 meg connection. You know, we're able to bring a $300 connection in. You know, I'm using round numbers and offer a 10 meg connection for $300 a month. So we've cut in half what they would have paid for a 1.5 meg connection. We've multiplied it by about 7.5 times of increase in bandwidth and drop the cost by as much as 50%. And 60 cents of every dollar is going back to the community.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to the breakdown between operating and fundraising. Now, I am currently writing a number of pieces about broadband in urban areas because I think that, you know, obviously a lot of the focus on broadband has been for rural communities because it's clear that, you know, there's just not a lot of infrastructure of any sort being made available to them. But there is a sort of this unrecognized or underrecognized aspect of things, which is urban areas have infrastructure issues too, in mainly in low-income areas where they are not perceived as offering high ROI. They're not likely candidates for triple play purchases. They are in areas where over time the infrastructure has deteriorated or it has become oversubscribed. And in all of those cases, the large companies are reluctant to spend money for new infrastructure in those communities. Could not a East LA or a low income part of the community of an urban area be a candidate for a foundation to build its own infrastructure?
Well, Craig, I certainly think it could. It would certainly require some very strategic partnerships being built as you build the foundation, and then as the foundation reaches out, you know, at some point you are going to need the help of local business and local telecom companies to help you do some interfacing. If, for instance, you're taking a underserved or oversaturated region and it's a small sub-community of something as big as L.A., you would still need the local service providers to help you make some of the connections. But, yeah, certainly you could go in there and lay out 6, 8, 9, 20 miles of fiber in that area and make some connections and then connect that point of presence to the world through several different resources. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Although I would say that in those environments, you know, it can be somewhat, you know, it's going to take some time and some energy to try to overcome. One of the things that we've been very beneficial in having in Steuben County is that Bill especially has done just an outstanding job on behalf of IMAN at creating some strategic partnerships between our power providers, our electric utility providers, and IMAN. And that's been very critical because, as we all know, we're putting up a physical infrastructure. We're physically hanging a cable on a utility pole, or we're putting the cable and boring it underground. And we need to have the appropriate rights and access to right-of-ways, and we also need to be able to work on and be allowed to attach to the utility poles. And if we hadn't had that strategic partnership, I think it could have been a lot more difficult for us.
So basically, in the urban areas, it's going to be a higher, tougher road to climb just by virtue of, you know, the lay of the land. Like, quite literally, you've got things in place, you've got right-of-way issues. It's always harder to build conduit in urban areas, you know, the concrete jungle, as it were. So I can accept that. I know that, for example, I've had conversations with a small cable company in Philadelphia, and they serve predominantly low-income areas, and they're trying to, you know, they're grappling with the dollar and cents issue because the big companies don't want to go in because there's no return on investment. You know, they're a small company, so obviously capital is a big deal. But it would seem like, you know, if they partnered with the right, maybe the a couple of the universities or with a couple of the, you know, businesses that have an interest in that as a market, you know, could then become a partner in the foundation creation part and then let the cable company work through the mechanics and the, you know, the right-of-way issues and so forth. Might be a way to go.
No,
Craig, this is Sharon. I'm going to interject just a little story here about why it's important for local people to take responsibility for this. Folks in Steuben County know Sharon. They know Bill. They know Jad. You know, they see us at coffee in the morning. If there's a question, they can come up to us and say, hey, this is what's going on, or I hear about something or other. You know, just this morning, Bill had to go and talk to the rector at the Catholic Church because we needed a small easement area to be able to do some directional boring. And so, you know, you swap business cards and a cup of coffee and you say, this is what we're looking for, Pastor so-and-so. And, you know, that's how you make those things work. Relationships are very important. So if you're talking about inner city or, you know, multi or urban areas with specific niche areas, again, it's going to be about the relationships that already exist. And if you've got that network of people with names and faces and have proven track records of doing good things, again, it's going to pave that way for them.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, while we're talking about, you know, these relationships, when you and I spoke a couple days ago, we talked about the initial customers, in addition to the city government, are also those anchor institutions who I'm assuming were the backbone of the backbone. That's a little pun there, couldn't help myself. But they're a key part of this early, you know, coming out of the gate effort. Explain a little bit about how you worked with those institutions, those anchor tenants, as it were.
Well, we worked with them and it was a need-driven basis. As we built, they had a need, at which time when we were getting close to a facility that they needed to get to, we just grew. And from the monthly fees, it would allow us to go to the next and go to the next. So it's a puzzle. That's about the simplest way I can say this, is we're putting a puzzle together, and it doesn't have to be a piece connected to a piece. In our build, we built 2 miles apart. And eventually the pieces all came together. Mm-hmm. And we continue to build it that way. We have connections 10 miles apart. I built, there was a need in one community to connect a couple facilities, which we built that one. And now, in the next 2 to 3 months, we're going to tie it all together. So our puzzle for Steuben County within the next 6 to 9 months will be coming. You're going to start seeing what it looks like. And offer a lot of needs and services for a lot of businesses.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there someone who is driving the economic development impact of the network? And what I mean by that is you can put a network in place, but if you want it to impact economic development, I mean, forgetting the granting aspect of the foundation, but if you want the network to play a role in economic development, usually somebody has to, like, take that as a specific task. You have to build a plan. You have to build a structure, people, so forth, in order to get to that end point. Does something like that exist in Steuben County?
Oh, sure, absolutely. As a matter of fact, our local economic development corporation's executive director and their board of directors have earmarked the completion of IMAN as one of their priorities for their strategic plan. So the EDC obviously is looking for ways that they can drive business to the fiber, just as the fiber is trying to get to the business.
Mm-hmm.
So they are very much partners.
Okay. And so, yeah, it was interesting when I did a survey of economic development professionals a few months ago. One of the questions dealt with, you know, do you have a plan? Do you have an actual economic development plan that incorporates broadband? And the higher percentage of communities that actually have broadband worked into their economic development plan were rural areas, which I found interesting, though probably logical, considering that I think in some rural communities they feel that. Need for economic advancement, probably more so because they're so close to the edge of, you know, failing as cities or towns or what have you. And so as a result, they're going to be more aggressive at the planning their way out of this particular dilemma, is sort of my take on the thing.
I read that survey, and I was intrigued by some of the responses as well, including the fact that almost half of your respondents believed that it should be a community-owned fiber structure as opposed to, you know, one of the large incumbents coming in and developing a plan for them.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, I think that was the result of your research.
Right. There was a, you know, there's a fair amount of support. You know, I look at the glass a little, you know, differently sometimes, because I'm always wondering, well, why isn't there a greater sense of, you know, the community can do this. And I think part of it is maybe people don't understand the options. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation today, because I bet dollars to donuts, you know, a lot of people advocating for broadband haven't looked at this as an option because they just don't have any examples of it. and you know, I'm hoping that in a year, you know, this will turn around a little bit. Do you get many wireless ISPs interested in becoming part of the network?
You know, yeah, Craig, this is Jad, and mm-hmm. one of the things that we do have that. We have them the wireless ISPs are wanting to put some of their end nodes where their distribution points are going to be on the end of the fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the fiber to connect back to their primary distribution point, and then out at the end, for instance, on top of water towers or on top of other vertical towers, they're able to put their transmission equipment. And so they're not trying to backhaul all the data from their customers across a wireless connection. They backhaul it across the fiber connection, which allows them a greater bandwidth and, of course, less congestion on their network.
Mm-hmm.
So, indeed, it does help the distribution. One of the other things we're looking at doing is we're talking to some of the big cell phone providers about helping them backhaul their data, because traditionally, especially in the rural areas, the cell phone towers are backhauling wirelessly, and they would much prefer to backhaul on fiber. So one of the things we're looking at doing is getting in and helping them with some fiber connections and helping them get off of their towers onto the ground and into the fiber network so that they can more easily and at larger volumes be able to transmit that data.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to jump back to real quick about kind of the methodology. One of the things that, first off, let me make it clear. IMAN started from a design criteria that Bill and I put together. It went back to about 1999, and it started with a feasibility study, actually, from a local economic industrial, what we call it, the Angola Industrial Growth Board. This was a group of, I'd call them founding fathers, but certainly business owners and community representatives who had traditionally helped the Steuben County area develop their industrial growth parks. And what had happened in the late 90s, in the boom of everything that was going on in northeast Indiana, Steuben County ran out of industrial property. We were getting more demand for businesses wanting to move in without the ability to have, we didn't have ready, basically ready to build sites for our industry to move in. So one of the things that began to drive this was and this is where I wanted to get back to with your economic development, how do we make it more cost-effective and easier as a digital plan using broadband to help help make the multiple, there's five different primary communities in Steuben County, how do we use and leverage their industrial parks that may not be at full capacity, whereas Angola's was at full capacity. And that's where Bill and I really started with a feasibility study. We laid out what we call digital real estate, and we said we're going to build a fiber network to connect the physical real estate with digital real estate that will allow the business to say, look, if you want to move into Angola, we've got a 60,000 square foot parcel, or we can build a 60,000 square foot facility. But up in the next town of Fremont, which is also in our county, we've got room for another 120,000 square foot facility up there. But because we have fiber between these two locations, your cost to connect these two buildings together from a phone, voice, video, and digital data standpoint will be next to zero. Well, that makes the value of those two properties go up. While they're independently in different communities, they're only, so many miles apart, 8 miles apart. And, business owners are able to look at that and say, okay, well, we can put off-site warehousing up in this other community and have our manufacturing facility in the first community. And because we have digital real estate, because we have broadband fiber connecting it together, it makes that that much better. The other thing is, by having literally a map, we built an entire map. We delineated inside our feasibility study where the fiber was going to go, how much fiber was going to be put up, where it was going to connect to, what was going to be the phased implementation plan, and what were going to be the stakeholders, who was going to be able to connect to it, and what were they going to do with it. And in doing so, I think a lot of people out there, they look at this and they say, well, we want to do fiber, but it looks as though it's such a big task, it may be daunting and almost impossible to actually get done, when it's really far easier. And one thing I'd like to add, don't let anybody tell you that you're not allowed to put fiber up on utility poles in your community. And we have some communities in northern Indiana that their school districts and their municipalities were told they weren't even allowed to build their own fiber. they weren't allowed to be in the right-of-ways. They weren't allowed to connect to the utility poles. That was only for the cable providers or for the big telco companies. And that's just simply not true. Anybody can be there, but certainly you have to follow the rules and you have to do your due diligence and you have to make your own relationships in order to make that happen.
Well, that seems counter to the folks that say, well, I guess people who bring this up, but when you say that you can't be kept out or off of those poles, how is that true?
Well, because those poles are granted to the utility company by the de facto that they are a monopoly. You don't normally have five different power companies running their separate power poles down the sides of the streets. There's only one in each community. Therefore, by the letter of the law, they have to allow – now, they don't have to make it easy for you to connect onto their utility pole. But they certainly have to give you the opportunity, and you have to follow the same rules that any utility would.
So who is it that usually makes the rules? Because I got the impression that every community it could be a different body that makes the rules. In essence, the right-of-way rules for the utility poles, right? Or are we basically at a disadvantage because we name them utility poles and they're not utility poles? They're just poles that exist, and utility companies are the primary ones that use them?
Really, it comes down to who bought the poles. Who's the physical owner? For instance, we have the NIPSCO, the Northern Indiana Public Service Company, who owns our primary utility, our electric utility in Steuben County. Well, NIPSCO owns the poles, and the rules are delineated by primarily, and Bill, maybe you can jump in and help me, but they have their own rules for how the cable gets mounted on those poles and where everybody's going to be. Bill, can you clear that up?
Yeah, each utility company has their own rules. NIPSCO has a standard that they go by, and before IMAN can touch their poles, we'll do an engineering study on their poles for them and show them that their poles are not overloaded. And if they are overloaded, what do we need to do to correct them before we can attach to them? And they have a standard. REMC has a different standard. They're our rural electric company here in town in Steuben County. So we deal with really three power companies. Then we have AEP, which is another utility, and they have their standards. All three are different, and you have to understand what their requirements are and what they require before we can attach to them and abide by their rules. After which time, they won't I don't want to say deny you, but you're going to pay a pole attachment fee every year. It may be X amount of dollars up to 500 poles, like $1,000 a year to attach to 500 poles. And that's your fee for attaching to those poles. And they're all going to be different. So you got to do a little feasibility study, see where you're going, and what the routes are going to be in your community, and what we call make-ready costs are going to be. And in some situations, you're going to bury it because it's going to be cheaper to bury interduct than it is going to be to pay for make-ready costs. So,
but I'm not sure I'm understanding. Isn't what you're saying, though, is that the utility companies own the pole, and so subsequently, if they're the owner, they could basically make a rule that says you can't be on their pole?
No, they can't deny you to be in the right-of-way or on their pole. Like
they can't deny you because of law, state law or local law? Or?
Mm-hmm. In our Steuben County area, that is. I mean,
well, they can't deny you primarily because they're a monopoly. And either the county government, the local government, the state government has given them the right to put their network up. They've come and made their investment. For them to be able to deny you access in the right-of-way or on their poles. Now, they can tell you that their poles are overloaded. They can tell you that you may have to buy them new utility poles, bigger ones and stronger ones, and you may have to pay to have them install it. But at the end of the day, they're not going to bar you from doing it. And that's primarily why if you're driving down the side of the road in your community and you look up there and you see the electrical cables are up on top, and then about halfway down the pole you'll see the first telephone wires appear, and below that there may be some fiber cables, and below that there may be some other types of low voltage cables attached to it as well. And they have to meet a standard off the ground, so you don't want trucks driving through them and pulling them down. they have to meet a distance away from each other on the pole, and they have to meet a distance away from the high voltage electricity that's up on the top portion of it. But there's not going to be all the utility companies all work together to utilize the same resources, and certainly there's fees involved and whatnot, but it's not, you know, your community is not going to be, should not be under any circumstances held hostage by your local utility. And let's understand something. Your local utility has every advantage in helping, especially a community foundation, build their own broadband initiative, especially if it's done right. It's good for the community. It's good for everybody there. As we like to say, I think every taxpayer in Steuben County is going to find out that this community foundation-built network is going to touch every person there. We're planning on helping our community 911 center attached to their high-bandwidth radio transmission tower to pass more data out to every fire truck and police car that's out in our community. And currently, the limited bandwidth that's available to our distribution tower is stopping a lot of data that we need to get out there. So our fiber network's going to help build that, which would mean to me that every single person in the community is going to be advantaged by the foundation building this fiber network.
Right, but it sounds like there is still some negotiation process that has to happen, and that in the course of that negotiation, you could still be at a disadvantage. But it sounds like you're saying is the bottom line is they can't deny you if you really push it far enough. But you're going to have to
make it difficult for you, but they can't deny you.
Correct.
And the other thing you need to understand is adding fiber is going to add to the utility's bottom dollar, because if we can bring infrastructure in and economic development, that means more businesses and more homes to heat and power.
Huh.
Well, and Craig, let me explain something else. One of the things that we're getting into as well in our community is that, you know, the utility companies, they want to know what's happening with their power. Their product is the power that they're delivering to every home and business in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that all their equipment has ability to do is to be network managed and be network monitored. And you, a lot of times, if you're good at building some relationships, you may find that if you were to give a couple strands of fiber, for instance, to your utility company to help them connect their substations together, they'd be able to do remote monitoring much more effectively than they could with standard wireless technology.
So in the end, it's all about you got to be prepared for a negotiation journey, it sounds like, which is, I mean, that's fine. At least I think people just need to understand that, and because I think the general conception is that, you know, if you are in certain communities, you can indeed be denied, and I think it's more what you're describing is that it's not so much that you can be denied as some people's road will be a little harder to cover than others, depending on the person and personality of the utility. And I'm sure that being a private utility is probably different, you know, amount of sledding than a public utility is, depending on where we're talking about. So let's talk a little bit about the money side of things. One of the things I find fascinating is that, I believe if I'm correct, your average business user is paying about, you know, $205 a month for service. By the way, how much speed is that? Do they get for that?
$225 a month is a standard business connection.
For how much speed?
And they're up to a gigabyte.
Up to a gig?
Yeah.
Up to a gig.
Okay. So let me ask this question, because this is the crux of the matter, and then we got about 10 minutes here. If I'm collecting $225 per subscriber, and 65% of that, after the build out is done, after you finish building out the network, 65% of that goes into the foundation for giving, for grants.
Mm-hmm.
How does that thing make? How does it break even? You know, because you've got people talking about, you know, a gig for, you know, hundreds of dollars and maybe even a thousand in some places. How do you make these numbers work?
Well, first you got to understand we don't have a debt service, because all dollars that we're building on are what I'll call free dollars. They've all been granted dollars to build the network, so we have no debt service, okay? And the overhead. There is... Today, there's only three of us that run this, okay, of which I probably do 90% of the work, okay, as far as building and developing.
Is that true, Sharon? Did you get away with that?
Oh. Jed and I will argue that with him some days, but yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but go ahead.
I didn't mean it to sound that bad, but as far as the day-to-day, doing the paperwork, the billing, the development, I'm hands-on 24/7 on the project. And, you know, it's been a process and a journey, and it's growing, and we've really stepped up here the last 2 years to where previous to that, you know, it might be a few hours a week. In the last 2 years, we've really stepped it up to its full-time job. And we're growing and growing fast, and glad for that, and glad for that for our community.
But we're still all contractors. There is no staff necessarily for IMAN. The Community Foundation has a staff. That's separate. We're all contractors. We get paid by the hour, so to speak.
Okay.
For the work
we
put into it.
So basically, in this structure, again, once you've covered the cost of the build-out, operationally, is it easier? I'm assuming it's easier to operate because really all you are providing is the infrastructure as opposed to the services, right? I mean, you don't really get into the... So you have customer service issues and so forth.
Correct.
That's correct.
IMAN still has to cover things like the billing and collection of the subscribers. Any maintenance that needs to be done on the wires, on the fiber. Locator service, you know, our worst nightmare is a backhoe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the time that's involved for us to go out and talk to folks about what this fiber project is and look for new subscribers and see if there's a way we can replicate this in our neighboring counties so that we can continue to hold hands with the next county and, you know, continue with that handshake.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of questions come to mind. What about the actual service? In other words, there's a connection and then there's a service. Because you're not in the service business, you get outside service providers. So are the businesses paying $225 just to have the connection and they still then have to pay for services that they get?
Yes. Two things
here.
We have point-to-point where a business wants to tie another facility together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally their fiber. They light it. They put the equipment on it. They got it. If they want to get connection or more, they can go for it. So they pay anywhere in Steuben County $225. Then we have service providers. So now we're going to go a point connection from one of those business locations back to the service provider. Depending on what it is, it could be $125 to $225 a month. And that's determined on if it's a single-strand fiber or a duplex-strand fiber. Okay.
Okay. But what they're paying for is actually the access to dark fiber. They're not paying for the service.
No, the service is on top of that because depending on what the service need is and the cost of that service is going to vary. It just depends on who those service providers are and what they're going to set their rates at, and IMAN does not control any of that.
Right. No, that's fine. It was more that I was missing a point, had to get that clarity thing in there to figure out, you know, the difference between access and service. But then the service can vary depending on what you're getting and so forth, and that makes a lot of sense. Is there any intent to provide fiber to homes?
I think I'll step up here on that one. Not really knowing how this business model would be received in our area, you know, over the last decade, IMAN chose to be a business model only at first. You know, we didn't want to bite off more than we could chew by offering residential services too.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, that as people learn about what's happening here, there is a greater demand for it at the home level. Our region here in Indiana is heavily marketed as a resort area, over 101 lakes to our credit. That brings in a lot of second home, what are called Lakers, who may want to make this their permanent residence if the right resources and infrastructure are in place. So entrepreneurial is a key issue of this project, and we'll sit down and visit Fiber to the Home when we get done with the initial 75-mile build.
What'll probably happen here is that we'll probably just take if there's underserved areas or areas that are developments of homes that don't have services. That's when we'll look at either having a service provider help us, and we'll reach out and try to service those homes, or we'll run the fiber in. But right now, you know, the price point's still high enough that most homeowners want to see a price point of $30 to $50 a month. And when each strand of fiber is still $112 a month, it without services on it, it's hard to get it to the price point that a homeowner is going to be willing to take up. These are rural communities. These are good, hardworking people. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't want to see your entire paycheck going out the door because you want to have cable TV and a telephone. And quite frankly, we have some cable providers and some phone providers in town that are doing a decent job with the residential side. So it's probably not our place to jump in and compete with them. But certainly if somebody's underserved, then we may have to look at that in the future.
Right. Let me ask this one question, probably my only political question. I have about 3 minutes or so left. I had an interview last week with USA Today working on a story. Wanted to talk about the cities that are having issues with the cable companies because the city is providing triple play service on their community network. And my response to them was, I think that if you are going to provide services, broadband services, go ahead and provide broadband services as a community, as a city, municipality, whatever, but try to avoid providing cable TV services because I think that's a big time sink. It's a money sink. No one's ever happy, and you just get, you know, shafted in the end. I mean, that was my blunt assessment. Is that an accurate assessment of, you know, of the triple play, where TV should fit or not fit?
I would agree with that. We don't view that as being a place where we, at least not a space that we want to play in.
Right.
It's far easier to help the businesses, and or if there's a residence have, you know, internet access, possibly going as far as voice over IP and doing some VoIP services, although, you know, you have to be somewhat even careful with that. But the minute you try to get into the whole thing and you're going to run cable, you know, that's really best suited for the cable companies, and I don't know that that's something that I agree with your statement.
Okay. So any parting thoughts here? We got about 2 minutes. You seem to have neutralized the political issue because of how you're structured. True? Is that the case? You don't really get much political flack?
No, haven't had that at all.
Excellent.
You had shot me a question earlier about why should other communities consider the foundation approach? And as I've thought about this, I'm going to go back to, we haven't made mention of this before, but Craig, I was the CEO at the Steuben County Community Foundation when this project started in 1999. That's why I know it can be done. I've been there, done that. The glory of this is that instead of profits leaving town and going to some unknown shareholder in another state, our profits recycle within our own neighborhoods. If I spend $1,000 a month on connection fees, and I know that $650 of that will stay here to help provide funding for the new bike trail or the food pantry or a college scholarship, I feel better about the decision I've made, not just that I have fast, secure, and affordable bandwidth. And I will also say that we're taking responsibility for our own broadband destiny. You know, we're not waiting for a large incumbent to come our way and manage the fiber that it provides to us in the form of packages.
Excellent. We're going to have to wrap. I don't want to interrupt. I'm sorry. I know where you're going with this, and I definitely agree wholeheartedly. I want to thank all three of you for being guests today and enlightening us, our audience, about the values and virtues of the Community Foundation as a broadband strategy, and I think this is excellent. I'm a believer. If I had the capability, I'd be playing the Monkees song. You know, I'm a believer. Well, anyway, never mind. Some folks don't remember that, but in any event.
I do.
You guys weren't supposed to tell them your ages like that. I was just, you know. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here. This has been a lively, as promised, a lively discussion. I think everybody appreciates. And best of luck. We'll be in touch soon. And I hope we see our audience again next week. Take care.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.